From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, an actor who has great legs and isn't afraid to use them. We talk with Charles Bush about why dressing in drag freed him as an actor. Bush has written and starred in plays spoofing and paying homage to Hollywood. His Vampire Lesbians of Sodom was Off-Broadway's longest-running hit. Also today, wiretapping the mob. We talk with retired Lieutenant Remo Franceschini about his career-long pursuit of New York's organized crime families. He personally bugged John Gotti's social club. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new thriller Rising Sun, starring Sean Connery and Wesley Snipes. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Clinton staged another gathering of supporters today to push for a quick package of a deficit reduction package. The president appeared with people who are identified as working poor who'd benefit from his proposed extension of the earned income tax credit. The president also said he's strongly in favor of a provision in the House version of the bill that would limit spending on entitlement programs. Republicans in the Senate have threatened a filibuster against that provision. If the measure fails to get into the compromise deficit reduction bill, the president said he'll try to curb entitlement programs by a separate bill or by executive order. For a second time in a week, American planes have fired on suspected Iraqi missile sites in the UN-imposed no-fly zone over southern Iraq. NPR's Andy Bowers reports.
The Pentagon says today's incidents occurred about 2 hours apart and involved two aircraft flying in separate formations over the no-fly zone. Both discovered they were being illuminated by radar from Iraqi surface-to-air missile sites, and each plane then fired a single radar-tracking missile at the sites. Both aircraft then returned safely to the carrier Abraham Lincoln in the Persian Gulf. Speaking at the White House today, President Clinton said the action was nothing new.
There is nothing out of the ordinary about what happened. Was not part of any new initiative. It was part of the old understandings under which our planes operate in that area and under circumstances under which they respond.
The Pentagon says another U.S. aircraft fired on an Iraqi missile site last Saturday, but Iraq's government has repeatedly denied that any of the incidents took place at all. I'm Andy Bowers in Washington.
Justice Department officials say that John Demjanjuk's acquittal today on war crimes charges in Israel doesn't necessarily mean he'll be allowed to return to the United States. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
After the Israeli Supreme Court unanimously acquitted Demjanjuk of being Ivan the Terrible, U.S. justice officials told reporters that his immigration status remains the same. Neil Schur, director of the Office of Special Investigations, said there is still ironclad documentary proof that Demjanjuk was trained as a death camp guard at a site called Travniki and was later transferred to the Sobibor death camp in Poland. In addition, Scher said Demjanjuk lied about his wartime activities when he applied for entry into the United States in 1950. But Ohio Congressman James Traficant, a Demjanjuk supporter, says the Justice Department botched the investigation and that he will introduce a private bill in Congress granting Demjanjuk's return to the United States. Scher said he believes that Demjanjuk's only chance of returning is an executive order by President Clinton. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 14 points to close at 3,567. Advances led declines by 2-1. This is NPR. A federal appeals court in New York ruled today that begging is a form of free speech. The decision upholds a lower court ruling that said New York City's ban on panhandling on public streets and in parks is unconstitutional. The lower court said that indigent people have a constitutional right to beg peacefully on the streets. The appeals court said there's little difference between those who solicit for organized charity and those who solicit for themselves. FBI Director nominee Louis Freeh appeared before the Senate Judiciary Committee this afternoon for the first day of his confirmation hearing. The U.S. District Judge was appointed after President Clinton fired William Sessions from the job. NPR's Tui Vu has more.
Jeffrey is no newcomer to the FBI. He was a special agent from 1975 to 1981. He then went on to become a federal prosecutor and gained national fame for his role in the so-called Pizza Connection case. The case targeted a Sicilian mafia's drug operation, which used New York pizza parlors as fronts. In his opening statement today, Free cited the World Trade Center bombing and warned of a growing terrorist threat.
Weapons technology has proliferated. Countries that are clearly terrorist nations now have dreaded arsenals.
Free is considered a specialist on organized crime. The 43-year-old judge was nominated just one day after William Sessions lost his job following accusations of ethical improprieties. Free is expected to win quick Senate confirmation. I'm Thuy Vu in Washington.
The Commerce Department reported today that the nation's economy grew at a modest pace during the second quarter. The nation's total output of goods and services, the gross domestic product, grew by 1.6% from April through June. That followed a sluggish first quarter when the GDP grew by only 0.7%, but it was much lower than last week's prediction from Federal Reserve Chief Alan Greenspan. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Charles Bush discovered who he was as an actor when he became a leading lady. He now writes and stars in gender-bending plays that are both tributes to and send-ups of Hollywood. His Vampire Lesbians of Sodom was the longest-running play in off-Broadway history. His Psycho Beach Party spoofed two Sally Field roles. He starred as a teenage girl who wants to be a surfer but suffers from multiple personality disorder. The Lady in Question was a melodrama set in the 40s. New York Times critic Frank Rich described Bush's performance as recalling Bankhead, Bacall, Stanwyck, Davis, and Russell, a walking anthology of feminine Hollywood legends. Rich asked, but what actor of either gender could top Mr. Bush? Now Bush is starring in a cabaret review at the Ballroom in New York, where, of course, he gets to dress in glittery evening gowns. He says he didn't find himself as an actor until he put on lashes and heels. I wanted to know what dressing in drag brings out in him.
Well, what it initially brought out in me was a whole sense of freedom and expression that I didn't have. It was a rather liberating experience for me at first. I think things have sort of changed as I've kind of grown up, become maybe more comfortable with myself. But when I started out, I used to do a one-man show for years that I booked around the country called Charles Bush Alone with a Cast of Thousands. And at the time, I wasn't in drag. I would be just kind of in black pants and a shirt. And I played many different characters, and it would be kind of a narrative where I would have to play every character that, you know, that I needed in that particular story. And so often there'd be male roles that just weren't really right for me, and I didn't think I was really very good at, and I thought I was rather stiff, and somehow the female characters seemed the more fun, you know. Often women can just be, in our society, can be more flamboyant, more expressive at times, so I enjoyed that. And then when I started performing with my theater company in the East Village in the 80s, I decided just to put on, you know, this outrageous drag outfit. We really thought it was just going to be for a weekend. Little did I know it would be my career. But it was a very liberating experience. And I wasn't, for the first time, I wasn't thinking about, oh, what do I do with my hands? It just somehow it came very natural. The interesting thing I find now, though, thousands of performances later and thousands of pairs of eyelashes later, that what was so liberating is beginning to feel a little confining. And I'm actually ready to de-drag for a while, to be a fella, because it just, after all this time, I've been doing it since 84, sometimes it feels a little bit just confining to have my creativity always filtered through this sort of female persona.
What do you think the difference is between what you're doing on stage and what more traditional female impersonators have done? The female impersonators who specialize in Betty Davis and Judy Garland, Barbara Streisand. Mm-hmm.
Well, because they are doing specific people, and I do different characters that are sort of my own invention. Although sometimes I kind of
do a little Judy.
Or if I'm doing, like, at one point in the show, I do this old movie sketch, and I kind of slip into a little Betty Davis at times just to kind of punctuate the line, or a little Susan Hayward. But I It's basically my own character, I like to think.
But it also seems to me that you're more consciously gender-bending than a lot of your predecessors.
Yeah, yeah. But I sort of straddle the fence in many ways. It seems that you can sort of divide female impersonators into two groups. Those who are comedians and are pretty, you know, kind of outrageous-looking and somewhat maybe even grotesque, but are very funny. And then there are other female impersonators who go to great lengths to create this perfect illusion of beautiful femininity, and often they kind of lip-sync to songs or, you know. But I'm sort of in the middle because I'm a comedian, but I look kind of good in those gowns. My legs ain't bad, you know. So I'm sort of in the middle. And I must say, too, I've lost any bit of integrity I may have had. Or I used to go to great pains where when I would do shows that I never wore falsies, that I wasn't really trying to convince the audience of an illusion. I was just kind of giving the notion of a general idea. But I don't know. Maybe it's just I've gotten older. But I'm so padded up. I think I've got two editions of the Sunday Times in each hip. You know, and you know, my God. You know, I go to great pains now to look very lovely. So you know, I'm very careful about the lighting. So I don't know what that is. Maybe it's just the more you do it, the more you kind of get into it.
You know, some drag queens object to feminism because it's not feminine enough, and really some drag queens really believe in traditional gender roles.
Yeah, I would think so. Isn't it interesting? And yet, I guess, you know, I was raised in a largely female household with two sisters that I'm very close to, and so the issues of feminism have always been rather real to me. And so I've always kind of prided myself that the female characters in my plays are sort of feminist role models. I always sort of played the career woman, you know, battling that devil man. You can't trust him, you know. So I've kind of liked it, and I have a female following. You know, I think there's, you know, always going to be somebody who's upset by something you do, and I'm sure, you know, some women might just find the whole notion of drag just offensive, and no matter what you do, you know, even if I did the Kate Millett story, they wouldn't like it, you know. But I, in my heart, I know that I respect women, and I love the kind of women that I admire, so are such strong women.
For our listeners who haven't seen your shows, let me ask you to say a couple of words about a couple of your shows.
Okay.
Let's start with Vampire Lesbians of Sodom.
Those are four big words. Strong words.
And, well, you know, not the of.
But we had, you know, a hard time, you know, when that show first started in 80, we started in 84, we moved it commercially in 85, and the New York Times wouldn't print the name in the ad.
Really?
Yeah, and I thought, you know, gee, it must be... I think if the play was called The Lesbian, they would have printed it. If it was called Vampires, or even if it was called Sodom, but you put them together and, oh boy, you know, head for the hills.
So tell us what it was about.
Well, it was kind of like a series of vaudeville sketches more than a play. And I played a lovely virgin sacrifice in ancient Sodom who is bit by the very glamorous succubus creature, this kind of Mae Westian vampirus, and she, the virgin sacrifice, because of this bite, becomes a vampire too. And so the two of them are kind of in a race across time as they go through various centuries trying to steal each other's thunder. And kind of the joke of it was that they were both, after they left Sodom, they both were in show business. And so we saw them in Hollywood in the 20s where there were vamps and silent films, and then in Las Vegas today, and they're still at it. So it was, you know, it was a cute show. And what I liked about it, too, is that underneath all the very silly campiness, I thought it had a little something to say about relationships, and I think that many of us have friends or even, you know, relatives who could just drive us crazy, and you'd like to murder at times, but if they weren't around, we'd certainly miss them.
Well, what was the very first time you dressed in drag?
Let's see. Well, I think when I was about 9, I think Bobby Fitzpatrick next door wanted us to put on his mother's evening gown. But other than that, it was many years later. I was in college and just dressing up for Halloween. But I learned really right away, it occurred to me that I got kind of bored when I just put on the dress and makeup and everything, got all rigged up, just as an end to itself. It just, I got kind of restless and sort of tired too. You just kind of want to spread your legs and, you know, and relax, you know. And I needed to have the role. It's, for me, drag is so connected with the theater that I can't separate it. That as soon as I like for instance, we had a float in the gay parade this year, and I put together this outfit to I mixed and matched, and but this at this point I certainly can't. I've got probably more clothes than you have. I mean, I've a lot of dresses for every occasion. You know, if you need.
I'm sure you have more heels than I do.
Yeah, well, call me. You know, and so. Anyway, so I put together this outfit to wear, just to wear, you know, in this open car. And as soon as I put it on, though, my mind was just racing so quickly. I was suddenly I was Melina McCrory in Never on Sunday. 5 seconds later, no, I'm Audrey Hepburn in a 60s caper film. Oh no! And it was so dizzying that I finally was just getting like hyperventilating just because of the images in my head of the different roles that I could play in that costume. So it wasn't enough just to be, you know, don't I look swell in this lovely couture creation.
You know, it's really funny. I feel like I should ask you for tips about how to walk in high heels. I've never been able to wear heels.
Really? It's so simple.
not that I'm dying to wear them or anything, yeah, but yeah, my feet ache and I figure it's not worth it. So you want to give me some tips?
Oh, I could run the decathlon in it. I could. You know, talk about drag racing. I mean, I could really. I walk better in heels, I think, than in flats somehow. I've fallen arches, kind of. I think the heels help me. But I must say, after a number of hours, it's agony. I had this part in the sequel to The Addams Family, which is coming out in November, and I play their cousin, the Countess Aphasia Addams Du Barry, and I was in high heels for 17 hours, on a movie set, and that was rather horrifying, you know. But for a couple hours, I don't know, you just sort of balance yourself and. I took to it like a duck to water. You know, I never quite understood when you see movies like Tootsie where the guys get in heels and they're wobbling all over the place. And I know, I guess it's for comic effect, but I never found it so tricky.
Actor and writer Charles Bush is my guest. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Charles Bush. He's currently performing his drag cabaret act in New York. Did dressing in drag or doing theater in drag coincide at all with figuring out your sexual identity?
In a certain sense, it did. In just that, when I was in college, I was coming out gay, and I came out gay with a sledgehammer. I mean, I was just, you know, out. Awful, you know, just outrageous. My best friend and I, and we just, you know, it was sort of during the height of kind of the David Bowie sort of, you know, glitter rock period. We had red hair and, you know, eyeliner on, and I had this awful big fun fur, this big fur coat on. I thought I looked like Maria Schneider in Les Tango of Paris, but don't know if everyone else shared that opinion. But anyway, at the same time, I'm taking these acting classes, and the roles that you would work on in class would be like, you know, Bo and Bus Stop or Biff and Death of the Salesman, and I just did not identify at all. And there just were there are no roles to that or anything, you know. And particularly like in college, we would be in it was kind of a method sort of, you know, Stanislavski approach where you're supposed to be using elements of your own, you know, past and your emotions, and it was very hard for me to identify. And so, consequently, there were, like, no roles that I even wanted to play. And I was really tormented because I was obsessed with acting and all my life wanted to be an actor. And I thought, well, if there are no roles in the repertoire that I am desperate to play, what's the point, you know? And I thought, I could be the boy in Equus, but there are many other fellas who could play it a lot better or just as well. I wanted to be special. I wanted to be unique. And I always wrote, and then I was always kind of improvising different characters for my friends. And I had a friend who said, well, this is who you are. This is what you should do. And it took me a while to to really realize that was the case, and that what I really loved was writing the story and telling it myself.
Did you actually make it onto the stage in roles that you didn't identify with? When you were trying to,
I usually never got them. Uh-huh. I usually wasn't cast because they're, you know, someone else who was more comfortable with it. I was uncomfortable with my masculinity, and in a way, I think now, after all these years doing drag, for some reason now I feel just more at ease with myself and ready to you know, go from leading lady to juvenile. A leap, isn't it? Unique one. And also, I tell you the truth, you know, there's so much drag around nowadays. I like to think that maybe I helped pave the way. Of course, I was helped by Charles Ludlam and Harvey Firestein, and people went on before me. But I think the success of Vampire Lesbians, you know, ran 5 years, and I think that certainly encouraged people to, you know, think of camp and drag as being a commercial possibility.
Do you think it's easier for you? You said you're more comfortable with your masculinity now. I mean, you've mm-hmm. been able to define what that is. It's not getting defined for you by the outside anymore.
I guess so. And for me, drag and assuming a female persona is not such a big deal. You know, I know there are great differences between the sexes, but in many ways there aren't. And at least for me, you know, I guess I have a slightly androgynous nature, and for me to go from male to female is sometimes just a question of how I cross my legs.
Can I quote something from the galleys of your forthcoming novel that mm-hmm. I've been reading? Yes. And the novel is called Whores of Lost Atlantis. It's a semi-autobiographical novel. And early on in the novel, the main character, who is very similar to you,
I should say so,
says, on a cloudy day, I can't tell whether I'm adopting the mannerisms of an effeminate man or a hard-boiled lady.
Yeah, that's sort of it. Yeah, that book's very personal. It was an interesting thing. When I began writing it about 3 years ago, it was going to be a very superficial kind of anti-mame sort of comedy book. And then the more I worked on it, and I realized that, you know, I was writing from the first person, and it was very much based on my experiences starting my theater company in the East Village in the 80s, I thought it was such a good opportunity for me to really explore, you know, my feelings about drag and androgyny and the creative process. And it was a very good experience for me. And so the book became much richer for it.
Well, let me ask you another question that comes out of the book, and I won't give away anything beyond this.
Oh, give it away if people will buy it. It just would kill me if, after all the work I did on this book, if it ended up in some little, you know, bin for $1.50, which I'm sure undoubtedly, ultimately it will. I won't go near the Strand bookstore for 2 years after that book comes out, because, you know, they always have things, you know, bargain books, even, you know, before they come out, but that would just kill me.
Yeah. Well, the main character who is, you know, starting his theater group finds himself having confusing sexual desires for the woman who does his wigs. And he says to himself, why did I have to feel heterosexual desires now just as I was emerging as a gay cult star?
Well, that's slightly based on fact. Actually, everything in the book has a kind of its germ in truth and then exaggerated. And I'm very, very close with my wig stylist, as anyone should be. And we, I'm really stuttering here.
You're at a loss for words.
I'm at a loss for words. You really got me here. I'm usually asked much more superficial questions. You know, what size shoe do I wear? I don't think sexuality is so cut and dried. At least mine is. Mine sexuality is rather baroque, actually. And I've certainly enjoyed I can't even say the word. That word, heterosexual experiences too, but I wouldn't. I don't call myself bisexual, but I have. And anyway, I don't know where we're going from this, but
Your character says, you know, that he's
but
worried.
It's confusing. So really, what I say in the book is sort of true. Is when I was involved with women, I would so torment myself with these odd questions of, like, you know, am I just using this woman somehow to be, you know, to allow myself to think of myself as sort of straight, or, you know, because I know I'm gay, and I just was difficult for me just to allow myself just to enjoy the experience.
Well, I'm sure you were also
kept saying, sham, you know. And then like in the book, when I was in a heterosexual relationship very briefly, I sort of justified it by thinking that I really felt like a lesbian. and I had this girlfriend for a while in Chicago who wanted to be bisexual, and we would go to lesbian bars together so she could meet someone. But people thought I was a lesbian. It was very confusing.
It sounds confusing.
Yeah.
And your character is worried that he'd be branded a turncoat by his gay friends if they found out he was having a heterosexual relationship. Was this a concern for you?
Oh, it never went that far, frankly, you know. But, you know, I exaggerate things in the book. But, you know, there is that notion in a way that I mean, often when I meet people who are gay, and a lot of them are getting married these days and having kids, and I think maybe such fear of the AIDS crisis and I don't know why, but I just notice it a lot. And some very outrageously effeminate men I meet, you know, who I know, and they say, I'll run into somebody on the street and I haven't seen them in a long time. And they say, my wife and I just had our first kid. I go, you're what? And I find myself very, I'm very judgmental, which I shouldn't be. But I sometimes wonder whether they're using these women in some way that's not really fair. I don't know.
Now, your father, I understand, listened to a lot of opera. And did he sell opera records?
No, my father, he had a record store, it's true. And I guess he did sell some opera records, although I think of him mostly having, you know, rock and roll. But his store was in Yonkers, so it wasn't really an opera haven. But he wanted to be a singer. And so he performed with different sort of semi-professional and amateur opera companies in Westchester, where I was growing up. And so my bedtime stories were the plots of Verdi and Puccini operas. And sort of the first theater I saw were these productions that he would be in, where everything, including the chorus, were painted on the backdrop. And I just was enraptured by it. And I think that whole idea of sort of cheap theatricality stayed with me, and certainly you can see it in my plays.
Yeah, well, that's certainly the larger-than-life type of play.
Yeah, I love melodrama so much, and even as much as I love the comedy. And so my plays are often, you know, sort of revenge dramas, and if you took away the element of parody or the, you know, the shtick or the comedy, you know, the stories themselves are stories of passion and revenge and, you know, good triumphing, and there's often, you know, somebody either jumps out a window or is being murdered. I think somebody's been murdered in just about every play I've written. It's kind of odd, you know, and they're comedies. So I think that really shows that earliest interest was in melodrama.
So while your father was feeding you these stories of the great operas and thus nourishing your interest in melodrama,
I had a very romantic sensibility. That was, by the time I'd say I was seven, my entire, everything that I'm interested in today was set.
But I bet your father was not very encouraging of your interest in acting out the parts of great actresses.
Oh, yeah, no, pas nécessaire.
No,
my father is so stage-struck.
Oh, really?
So stage-struck that I really could have done anything, and he would have been approved. And, I mean, just, I think when he sees my name on a marquee, I think he can sort of blot out the first name and imagine it's his own. I mean, he kind of lives vicariously through me, and I don't mind it at all, you know. So he lives in Florida now, but when he comes to see me in a show and, you know, I bring him backstage and he walks out on the stage, I can see him just sort of inhaling it in. He just loves it. And so he's seen all my shows, and that doesn't bother him at all.
Charles Bush performs his cabaret review at the Ballroom in New York until August 8th. Then he'll perform it for 2 weeks on Fire Island. His novel, Whores of Lost Atlantis, will be published in the fall by Hyperion. And you can see him in the forthcoming film, Adam's Family Values. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Retired Lieutenant Remo Franceschini hates it when the movies glamorize the mob. He knows wise guys for what they really are. For 35 years, he busted organized crime in New York City, keeping a wall of fame family tree of mobsters. His biggest challenge was pursuing John Gotti. Coming up, we talk with Remo Franceschini about his days as the head of the DA's squad of detectives in Queens. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new thriller Rising Sun, adapted from the book by Michael Crichton, who also wrote Jurassic Park. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Vice President Al Gore has added a new twist to the White House effort to win support for the president's economic package. Today, he made an unrestrained attack on the Republican leader in the Senate, Robert Dole. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Vice President Gore told a group of radio reporters that Dole's strategy is to boost his own chances for the Republican nomination for president in 1996 at the expense of the president's program and the entire nation.
He is counting on the Republicans' ability to create gridlock and economic catastrophe to boost the political fortunes of himself and other Republican candidates.
Vice President Gore claimed that momentum for the president's budget plan has now turned. He pointed to a Wall Street Journal poll that showed that support for the budget plan has gone up a bit by 4 points. His attacks on Dole seemed bolstered by another finding in that poll, that 64% of those surveyed felt Republicans were opposing the president's plan for political reasons. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
Israeli shelling of southern Lebanon continued for a fifth day. The strongest Israeli attacks in more than 10 years came after guerrillas tried to drive out Israeli troops in a self-styled security zone in southern Lebanon. Nearly 500,000 refugees have fled north this week in what a Lebanese health official terms a human catastrophe. Officials say both France and Kuwait have promised emergency aid, and they hope that other nations will do the same. Before Israel launched the operation, two guerrilla groups had killed 7 Israeli soldiers in the security zone. Israeli officials have served John Demjanjuk with a deportation order after the nation's Supreme Court found that he was not guilty of being Ivan the Terrible, a gas chamber operator in a Nazi death camp. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
John Demjanjuk will not be deported until a third country agrees to accept him. It's not clear if he'll be allowed to return to the United States. He lost his American citizenship for lying about his alleged Nazi past. There is also some speculation that Demjanjuk may apply for citizenship from Ukraine, where he was born. After the verdict, his lawyer asked that Demjanjuk be returned to his cell for his own protection until his deportation. The verdict has upset many Holocaust survivors who say the court made a mistake by ruling that Demjanjuk is not Ivan the Terrible. The court also said that while there was evidence that he was a guard somewhere else, it would be unreasonable to start a new trial after so many years. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up nearly 14 points to close at 3,567. This is NPR News. According to Pentagon officials, 2 U.S. Navy jets fired at 2 anti-aircraft missile sites in southern Iraq today, after the airplanes were locked onto by radar on the ground. U.S. pilots are on patrol of no-fly zones in Iraq and are under orders to fire missiles if they are tracked by Iraqi radar. President Clinton said this latest incident was not out of the ordinary or part of a new plan. The Pentagon says both airplanes returned safely to their carrier. Iraq has denied that any missiles were fired by U.S. planes at anti-aircraft sites in the southern part of the country. In Missouri, flooding is cutting the state in half. Record flood waters along the Missouri River have shut off passage to 2 of 4 bridges left open between St. Louis in the east and Kansas City in the west. Dave Cohen of member station KBIA reports.
The Missouri River and its tributaries are at record heights and still rising. In the state's capital, Jefferson City, the river is nearly 15 feet above flood stage, and the National Weather Service says a crest isn't due until Saturday night. Route 54 was the final connection between Jefferson City and the northern half of the state, and now that road is closed. Interstate 70 is the main east-west highway for the state, linking St. Louis to Kansas City, but part of that road is now underwater. As a result, what was a 30-mile trip is now more than 200 miles. The north half of the state is effectively cut off from the south half, except at the eastern and westernmost points. For National Public Radio, I'm Dave Cohen in Jefferson City.
The government says the nation's economy grew at a rate of 1.6% in the second quarter of the year, twice the figure recorded in the first quarter. However, many analysts had expected an increase in second quarter growth of more than 2%. Federal Reserve Board Chairman Alan Greenspan had forecast growth of 2.5% to 3%. This is National Public Radio News.
This is Fresh Air. Lieutenant Remo Franceschini spent most of his 30-year career trying to bust the New York mob. At the beginning of his career, he helped draw up the first family tree of New York organized crime. At the end of his career, he started an operation infiltrating the new generation of wise guys. For his last 13 years as a cop, he headed the DA's detective squad in Queens. He's written a new book about his pursuit of John Gotti and the mob, called A Matter of Honor. Franceschini was an expert on surveillance. In fact, in 1981, he personally bugged John Gotti's social club, the Bergen Hunt and Fish Club. This was before Gotti became the head of one of the crime families. Franceschini told me why he planted a bug at the social club.
We had been on a wiretap for 3 months on the Bergen Hunt and Fish Club originally. And on a wiretap, you can only get a certain amount of information, very cryptic information, but we were able to put together an organizational chart that worked for Gotti. We needed further information because we believed they were committing more serious crimes. So we had put in for a court-ordered bug. That's the difference between a bug and a wiretap. A wiretap, you don't have to actually enter the building. You can do that from the outside. But in order to put a bug in a building so you can pick up all the conversation, you actually have to go inside.
And you were one of the people who went in to plant the bug.
Yes, it was myself and two of my detectives who had technical skills.
What did you do when you got inside? I mean, how did you get in and plant the bug without the people who usually hang out in the club seeing you?
It was quite an experience because I'd been on these before when I was detective in the intelligence division 30 years prior to this. And we had court-ordered bugs, and we had to actually commit a burglary to go in, and we never had too many problems. Most of the time, the place was shut down for the night. But in a mob setting, in a social club, you never know when these guys are going to come back and forth. They could be playing cards all night, or they could pop in there at night. And the fact of the matter, there was another social club right around the corner, which was still open that night. That stayed open all night. And so we had quite a bit of risks in going in there and being spotted, and that would have aborted the whole investigation. And also we were very concerned with the neighbors in the area that were lookouts, actually, for these mob individuals. These mob individuals actually ran the neighborhood, and the neighbors felt safe around them as long as they were there to protect them. So we had chosen a certain night. We got there on Thursday night into Friday morning, and around 2 o'clock in the morning, myself and two of my detectives picked the locks in the back of the social club through an alleyway, and we were able to enter. However, it's not, you know, like you see in the movie, where you just drop a little bug in 10 minutes and you come out and you're all set. It's a lot of work involved in many cases.
Where did you put the bugs?
We used the wire from the phone as a conduit to our plant, because we had that wire up for 3 months, and that was in the front of the social club. However, we were more interested in the back room where they met, and they had tables and so forth, and there was no telephones back there. So that means we had to run wire and have it secreted in the wall down into the cellar. So it took quite a while. It actually took 3 hours. And during this period of time, I had detectives decoyed out in the street. What happened was that when we were halfway through, around 3:30 in the morning, the game was starting to break up around the corner to the other social club. They had a game going on there. And John Gotti's brother, Peter, came walking over to the Bergen. It was locked up from the outside, but for some reason he was coming over there and somebody else was coming with him. And he was standing right outside the Bergen Hunt and Fish Club. I must have been maybe 4 feet from him. And I could hear my surveillance people outside getting very excited, trying to distract him to some degree. And, of course, I didn't say too much back because I was concerned he may hear me if I do talk. And also, I didn't want to disturb the my detectives who were working as rapidly as they could. But we were fortunate he didn't come in. And some of my detectives diverted him by acting like they were hanging around the area and they didn't know them. And they were chasing them away. And in fact, they went over to one of my detectives' car and started banging on the car and saying, "Get the hell out of here." They didn't know whether they were trying to rip somebody off or he played like he was drunk and he eventually drove off.
Before you bugged Gotti's club, you had wiretapped the phones there. And in writing about that in your book, you say that people in organized crime just hate to be wiretapped because they're always saying nasty things about their bosses behind the boss's back.
Yes, that was Gotti's biggest fear at the time. You know, he was being bravado when I had to serve him with papers. And the law states that if you have a person on a wiretap and you expect to use that in court, you have to notify them that they've been intercepted on the phone, and you serve them with papers with that notification. And his biggest concern was, because he's a, sort of a foul-mouthed individual, and he's always complaining and he's griping about some of the bosses, because there's a tremendous amount of paranoia in the mob. They're actually always looking over their shoulders at who said what about them and so forth, and they had this Machiavellian-type mentality in dealing with other soldiers and capos in the mob.
My guest is retired Lieutenant Remo Franceschini. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is retired Lieutenant Remo Franceschini, author of the new memoir, A Matter of Honor, One Cop's Lifelong Pursuit of John Gotti and the Mob. Would you compare for us what it was like wiretapping phones when you started doing it for the New York City Police and what it's like now? Just legally, what you need in order to do it, what you're allowed to use.
You know, back in the 60s, there were a lot of people in law enforcement didn't really believe there was an organized crime. In fact, a few years prior to that, J. Edgar Hoover said there was no organized crime until the Appalachia meeting and embarrassed him, and then they started to put the FBI to work on it. But we were the ones that were able to get wiretaps in New York more readily than other states. Some states didn't even have a wiretap law. They did it illegal. But we would, the way it was then is a lieutenant and above in the police department could apply through the police commissioner for a wiretap order, and then you go to a judge for him to okay it. And you renewed it every 30 days. And it wasn't that difficult to show the probable cause for the wire. Of course, these wires were not used in a court of law against them. We gathered intelligence and we made arrests off them eventually, but it wasn't used, it couldn't be used in a court of law. But what we did in those days, in the 60s, in the early 60s, when I was a young detective, we ended up gathering a tremendous amount of information on who's who. As far as these families, the Bonanno, the Gambino, the Genovese, the Colombos, and the Lucchese crime family, those five major families, we are the ones that designated them into those family groups around 1965. And now, of course, mob figures themselves refer to their family that way. But we were the ones that designated them. And it was very difficult, and the only way we were able to do it was through bugging and wiretapping and through a lot of analysis. We couldn't depend just on informants alone.
When you were wiretapping and bugging the mob, where would you listen in?
You mean where would I actually be?
Yeah.
Well, in those days, we used to try to get a comfortable. We used to call them plants, and in many cases, we would sometimes we'd be in a terrible basement, you know, for weeks or months on a wiretap, and it wasn't too comfortable there. But we would try to find a plant that we could secure very well, usually a school. Where we take the principal into confidence. They didn't know what we were wiretapping, but we told them, we identify themselves. And in many cases, they were happy we were there because it was protection for them in case something serious happened in the school. And we would have the place secure and locked, and that's where we would do our wiretapping.
Is it boring to sit and listen all day? It
depends on the wire. You know, most wires are, you know, they're not boring. They're especially if you have a... you know, a bug in the wire where you're listening to most of all the conversations. As you know, today there's such a thing as minimization that you can't tape the conversations if it's not pertinent to the wiretap order. And so it's a whole different ballgame than it was then. But of course, everything you tape today you can use in court.
So how does it work today?
Well, today what happened is in the 70s, Title III came into effect. That's a federal statute that gave guidelines for wiretapping throughout the United States. In fact, it helped some states because they didn't have a wiretap law. And the way it works today, that the wiretap had to be supervised by a district attorney, a local district attorney or a U.S. attorney, and it had to also be supervised by a judge, a Supreme Court judge or a U.S. judge. And they would get reports and they would get what the wiretap was about as you're progressing. And also, you had to have what they call strict minimization, where if a person got on the phone that wasn't on the wiretap order and it was a call that wasn't pertinent, you would have to shut the machine off. You could not tape that conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And then...
you listen in anyways?
No, absolutely not. But what you could do, if you could take... In the beginning, you could take spot checks to see if they're still talking about the same thing, like it's a personal thing, and then shut it off again. And they give you a little more leeway in the beginning of the wiretap, and then as you progress on it, towards, say, the second or third week, they expect you to have shorter conversations because you know the voices then, who you really want to get. Now, if a crime alludes to a crime on the phone that's not in your wiretap order, well, then you could record it, but you immediately have to make up another affidavit and have it amended to include that crime.
Of all the times that you were sitting and listening to wires, what's the most explosive thing you ever heard?
Well, one of the most explosives actually was John Gotti. I had a tape of him that I thought he was going to come through the phone at one of his soldiers. And he threatened him, and he threatened he was going to kill him, blow his house up, and every second word was a curse word out of him. And it was really a very... You probably never heard a person speak the way he did, that he was actually coming through the phone. And later on, after that was used in court, I was able to use that tape with some U.S. Marshals that I was given a course on organized crime. And I saw some of them cringe when they just heard his voice, they got scared. It was a devastating put-down on his soldier, and he did it with such ferocity that I think it would scare anybody.
Now that you're retired, do you ever run into any of the mobsters who you've bugged over the years on the street?
Yeah, people spot me, and they know me because I was kind of evidently well known, you know, in the police department. I was in the papers a lot. I guess I was on TV a lot, so they do know me. They know my name, and I've always had the posture of not being friendly. I'm fairly aloof, and I don't rub shoulders with them or joke around with them because a lot of the mob guys, even John Guy, just like to banter with me, but I didn't accept it. And they kind of knew I wasn't approachable, so they sort of stay away from me. They all whistle to each other or they point. In fact, one time, right before Gotti went away, he was still out, I was down on Mulberry Street. I was walking a little Whitley near one of the clubs, and they spotted me, and it must have been about 30, 40 of them outside the club. And within a short period of time, there was only five outside the club. They all started to get into the woodwork, leave. You know, they didn't know what I was doing there at the time. Actually, I wasn't doing any at the time. I was with some out-of-town people, and I was socializing at the time.
Why wouldn't you banter with John Gotti?
I don't. That's one of their ploys. They like to get close to you, and all they're doing it for is eventually to put you on a defense. That's the only reason they're doing it. And you know, he banters a lot. He used to banter a lot, but I didn't banter a lot. I was very professional in dealing with him. And I found throughout my career, my 35 years, that was the best approach.
Now, Gotti's known for his great wardrobe, right? Fine suits. How did you dress?
No, I don't think I didn't wear $1,000 suits, but I always wore a suit, and I made it a point to portray a certain image in the police department. I felt that image meant a lot. In fact, one time at a roasting at a retirement party, or somebody said that Remo was so concerned about his image, he had his X-rays touched up. and I had my men the same way, and I had a very handpicked squad when I was out there, and very presentable individuals. And I felt the respect comes with that, and that was one of my, I think that's one of my strong points, not one of my bad points.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Retired Lieutenant Remo Franceschini is the author of the new memoir, A Matter of Honor, One Cop's Lifelong Pursuit of John Gotti and the Mob. This is Fresh Air. The Clinton administration seems to be shifting its policy on Bosnia. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what will you have on All Things Considered?
We'll hear about urgent discussions among the allies on changing and expanding the role of air power in Bosnia to possibly using air power to break the siege of Sarajevo. Also today, news of the conference committee and its attempts to pass a deficit reduction package, and to talk with a Democratic senator who's wavering, that's Senator Cole of Wisconsin. A story about a Washington, D.C. neighborhood, the scene of a recent notorious shooting. Talk with a resident who has stayed and one who left the neighborhood. And also a talk with Jonathan Tolens, the playwright, author of a new play called Twilight of the Golds, a science fiction, if you will, about predicting about genetic engineering.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. First, there was Jurassic Park, and now the Michael Crichton Summer Film Festival continues with Rising Sun, the movie version of Crichton's 1992 bestseller. The film was directed by Philip Kaufman, who made The Right Stuff, The Unbearable Lightness of Being, and Henry and June. Will the rampaging Japanese prove as seductive as the rampaging raptors? Film critic Stephen Schiff went to investigate.
Well, in the first place, the Japanese don't do all that much rampaging in this movie. Crichton's novel was paranoid about the Japanese, about how much smarter they are than we are, how much wilier, and how much more ruthless, and how they're taking over everything. In other words, Crichton was a Japan basher. Kaufman is much more politically correct, and that, I'm afraid, makes his movie pointless. If this isn't a picture that wants to scare us about the Japanese, then it's just a cop flick with sushi. At first, though, Kaufman seduces you with sheer stylishness. As Rising Sun opens, we don't know where we are. One reality seems to slide into another, and thoroughly disoriented, we settle back into our seats saying, ah, this must be what it's like for a Westerner in Japan. Hence, the movie's first disappointment. None of it takes place in Japan. The slick, faceless city we're seeing is Los Angeles, where a beautiful blonde has just been strangled during rough sex at a swanky corporate party in the Nakamoto skyscraper. Who done it? The powerful Nakamoto company has been trying to buy an American software firm, and it doesn't need a scandal just now. So when Wesley Snipes, as a police liaison officer, is called to the scene of the crime, he's ordered to bring along a mysterious Japan expert played by Sean Connery, who wears an elegant white beard and an array of zenned-out black Armanis. Driving through the rain, Connery presumes to instruct Snipes in the ways of the Japanese.
Keep your jacket buttoned at all times. If they bow, you bow back, same depth, same duration.
Believe it or not, I have done this before. You know, I do know these things.
And do keep your hands at your sides. The Japanese find big arm movements threatening. Keep your voice calm and even. You'll probably find them irritating tonight. But whatever happens, don't lose your temper.
I don't lose my temper.
Well, that's good to know. Now, when you start to get into trouble...
I won't get into trouble.
When you start to get into trouble, you'll hear me say, perhaps I can be of assistance. From then on, I do the talking. You stand behind me, and don't appear distracted. We may come from a fragmented MTV rap video culture, but they do not.
Rising Sun is basically that scene over and over again. First, you'll get a clumsily staged action sequence, and then Connery lecturing Snipes while Snipes splutters and fumes and says, "Wait a minute, I knew that." He's playing Rochester to Connery's Jack Benny. That oddly racist element aside, these are among the blandest performances the two stars have ever given. But Connery's presence alone sets up expectations. You remember the way James Bond would always infiltrate the mysterious villain's headquarters and usher us into the seat of power for the explosive climax. And so you expect Rising Sun to wind its way into the heart of Japanese corporate life, the Hall of Mirrors where the foreigners work their sorcery. The problem, of course, is that Kaufman doesn't believe in the Hall of Mirrors or in the sorcery. The Japanese have their good guys and their corrupt guys, and so do we, which is a very reasonable point of view. Too reasonable. In the end, Rising Sun is a thriller without bad guys. And a thriller without bad guys is no thriller at all.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Ron Barron, Chris Fraley, and Audrey Voblaitis. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurruck directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the Vanguard Group of Investment Companies with 74 mutual fund portfolios offering comprehensive investment and retirement services. 1-800-643-3393. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we continue our weekly edition of interviews from the archives with a couple of recent interviews that were preempted in many cities by a press conference and confirmation hearings. We'll hear from Randall Terry, founder of the anti-abortion group Operation Rescue, and from Catholic and feminist Nancy Mayers. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.